Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
We welcome you to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast, and a happy Super Bowl Sunday to all of our listeners out there. Trent Kling with you on this episode, Leighton doing more yeoman's work behind the scenes for us. Coming up today, we've got an interview with Quincy Valencia. Quincy is the VP of Product Innovation for Hourly by AMS. We are going to talk about hourly hiring. As a result, we're going to talk about how hourly hiring has shifted or changed, what needs to be done to make it better for both the retailer and the applicant, and how things need to continue to adjust and change into the future, as well as how the hiring process may be headed towards more automation in the future. We also will talk about two big announcements made by Dollar Tree this week in our news segment, and we'll look ahead to big news in the delivery sector as liquor delivery service Drizzly gets purchased this week. A reminder that you can like us or rate us on any podcast listening service that you may be using. Those ratings, as long as you enjoy us, help others to find us, and they also help out with the all-powerful Apple Podcasts algorithm. No one really knows what goes into it. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. So yeah, let's lead the show with those two big announcements made by Dollar Tree this week. One announcement for each banner, as it were, and we start with the first and perhaps most important announcement. This came via Instacart on Thursday, and the announcement revealed that Instacart and Family Dollar are expanding upon an existing pilot program. They've struck a partnership to introduce delivery services across over 6,000 Family Dollar locations. Now, although some media outlets reported that the service would be rolled out across all Family Dollar stores in the U.S., this isn't the case. Family Dollar has about 7,800 stores nationwide, so there are in the neighborhood of 1,800 stores that won't, at least just yet, have this Instacart delivery service available for them. And it would seem, based on my own personal research, that the service wouldn't extend to certain locations in far-flung rural areas. I searched five different rural areas with Family Dollars in them via Instacart. None of those services were available in those particular areas, but most of their stores in mid-size or large markets should have the Instacart service. And in fact, Family Dollar, their logo already features prominently on Instacart's website just a few days after this was announced. Now, the program, as I mentioned, it was piloted first. It was piloted in late 2020, starting with 275 Family Dollar stores. And it would seem that, based on management comments, the pilot went well, at least from an operational standpoint. However, we should note that operation success doesn't necessarily mean the partnership resulted in increased traffic for Family Dollar. So being able to pull off the pilot program is a lot different than the pilot program actually driving non-cannibalizing traffic. And I think this is an important distinction to make. We actually spoke with an Instacart shopper in one test market who indicated that the demand didn't seem to be tremendously high for Family Dollar. She mentioned that she was somewhat surprised to see it expanded this quickly, and went further to say that the lack of groceries, especially those fresh groceries, may be a main contributor. That particular market she works has much more traffic surrounding stores with produce and a larger meat selection, even though Family Dollar might have, you know, some things like lunch meat or eggs, for example. Selection's going to be a lot larger at, say, your Walmart store, your Target, in places where Target partners with Instacart, as they did in this particular market, as well as the grocery stores, both independent and national in that market. And she also noted, and I thought this was interesting, the layout of the stores, usually small aisles, inconsistent planograms, depending on store size. If you have a store that's 7,000 square feet, it's going to be a lot different, of course, than a store that might be located in an old grocery store dating back to the 60s or 70s, where you've got 12 to 15,000 square feet to deal with. But anyway, the layout not tremendously conducive to Instacart shopping, because she mentioned that the stores where the layout is simple, easy to follow, and more importantly, across a certain market, similar for all stores, that helps in terms of efficiency. And so there was some concern there, just again, about spacing of products, about availability of products, and about the width of the aisle. So kind of interesting perspective, again, from an Instacart shopper. However, you know, when you look at this circumstance, it may be more of a case of Dollar Tree, the organization, simply giving the option to customers rather than producing something they believe will meaningfully increase and boost business for them. And again, it's more about not losing customers when they're going elsewhere via Instacart versus maybe driving some of that traffic that, again, isn't cannibalizing on your existing store traffic. Now, CEO Mike Witynski in the Instacart release did mention that they were encouraged by the initial results of their pilot stores, and that is a direct quote. Again, some markets may have performed better than the ones served by the Instacart shopper we talked to. As we so often mention on the show, the plural of anecdote is not data, so it is important to keep in mind that some of the other stores may have performed better. Now, for dollar store perspective, or really for general merchandise store perspective, Dollar General is in the midst of rapidly scaling up their DG pickup platform. We've talked about that on previous shows where customers can order online and pick up in store. They don't offer curbside as yet, and they're very clear about the fact that they won't take your order out to you, but you can go into the store certainly and pick up your order. It should be ready for pickup. Dollar General also offers an auto ship program, which is also an internal program. So they're not partnering with an external source for this, for household staples as well. So you can have things shipped to your store on a particular schedule, not unlike what you would see with Amazon Prime or a number of other rollouts from the likes of Walmart and Target doing the same thing. Now, Family Dollar may have decided here that it would be either best or easiest or maybe more scalable to partner with an experienced third party for their last mile rollout. And who more experienced, quite honestly, than Instacart, one of the most powerful companies in this space. And the fact that Instacart serves around 80% of Family Dollar locations, or at least the areas that those locations are in, certainly helps overcome some logistical hurdles. Whether this will ever be available in rural markets, you're talking markets of less than 3,000 to 4,000 people, not quite sure that you're going to see that just yet. But again, Instacart serves around 5,500 cities. They cover a good portion, over 80% of American homes. So can't hurt, certainly, this partnership with Family Dollar. Now, in the second news story from the same company this week, Dollar Tree announced the full nationwide expansion of their Crafter's Square product set, basically saying, hey, it is in all stores now. And not only is it in all stores, but we are expanding it in stores where this product set existed previously. They've noted several times on earnings calls that their pilot stores for Crafter's Square saw an uptick in sales as a specific result of this section. So it seemed to be only a matter of time. And in fact, during their last quarterly report, Witynski noted plans to roll out to all stores by early 2021, and they have certainly delivered on that as they announced this week. Initially, the concept was rolled out to 3 stores a few years ago, then 800 by the end of 2019, 2,400 stores by Q1 of 2020, just prior to the pandemic onset. So really what you're looking at here is the culmination of 2 years of research and trials, something that Dollar Tree as a company is always willing to point out, which is that things don't move very quickly in this space out of necessity. When it comes to product sourcing, when it comes to research, when it comes to most efficient use of shelf space in what is oftentimes a very limited square footage that you've got in these stores, things have to move slowly. So it's just like, for example, the increase in candy sales at Dollar Tree or increase in shelf space for candy, the Dollar Tree Plus concept. These things are going to take about 2 years to gestate before you see them across the chain. We've reached the end of that gestation period, at least for Crafter's Square. What I really liked about this particular news release is that Dollar Tree is very specific as far as how the initiative would feature in their stores. Not only did they say that this section was now in every Dollar Tree store, but that shoppers would see an additional 4 to 12 feet of shelf space devoted to it in each store nationwide, which is, again, not insignificant. Of course, this is likely to vary based on store size and format. I mentioned Dollar Tree stores, much like Family Dollar stores, all over the map in terms of square footage, some as small as 6,000 to 7,000 square feet, some well into five figures in terms of square footage. Now, One thing I do want to note is that with this Crafter Square concept, you're not seeing a ton of products that are completely new to Dollar Tree. You are seeing some products maybe repurposed from previous other departments there. Dollar Tree has always had a relatively strong craft section, so it does come down a little bit to branding and a little bit to store layout as far as this is concerned. They note staples such as colored pencils, wood crafts, and scissors among the Crafter Square selection. These are things that you could already find in Dollar Tree pre any of these rollouts. However, additional products with the expanded shelf space will include hot glue guns, which for that price point, hopefully it's an effective hot glue gun, sewing kits, scrapbooking materials, yarn, wreath supplies, and so forth. And not only does this speak to the continued evolution of Dollar Tree, but I think it also gives us an indication of categories in which they're seeing sourcing success. You'll recall, as we've talked about Dollar Tree in the past, it's not always about where sales are being driven. It's not always about what customers are putting in their carts. It's about margin, and it's about sourcing those products well. And what I think we're seeing here is product sourcing has been a major topic for their leadership during the pandemic. Leadership has noted the inability to source certain products, particularly consumables, in the smaller sizes that are necessary for the Dollar Tree price point. So getting a package of bacon, for example, packed in a smaller size, that's been a little bit of an issue for Dollar Tree. So by expanding Crafter Square, we can see a couple of things. They're confident about continuing to increase inventory in this area because it's available, and they may be having more success sourcing products when it comes to those that carry high margins. So the decision to devote additional shelf space to crafting supplies and take shelf space from maybe an area where sourcing was becoming difficult for that size of product or margins were being squeezed, that's going to be an easy decision, or at least easier for management to make that decision. So we shouldn't read into it that Crafter Square products sell several magnitudes more than other products in stores, although we have seen increased same-store sales at their pilot stores. What we can say is this is a category that seems to check both of these boxes. They're focused on expanding discretionary categories that drive margin. That's a check. And they're focused on expanding discretionary categories that don't cannibalize current sales. Another check. So from that perspective, certainly it makes sense for Dollar Tree to be expanding this concept. And I think it also speaks to something that we talked about on a recent episode of the podcast when we talked about the dynamics with Hobby Lobby and Michaels and Joanne. You are really seeing people turn towards crafting, turn towards other ways to spend their time during the pandemic. Whether this will continue after the pandemic, whenever that happens to be, post-pandemic, time will tell, but we can see right now that there is a big push towards crafting. Dollar Tree began this initiative even before the pandemic came into play, but it seems as though the pandemic has really accelerated the onset of Crafter's Square. So excited to see this initiative take hold for Dollar Tree, and more than anything, excited to see how it'll impact their earnings during the course of 2021, not just in terms of the bottom line and in terms of margins, but also how it's driving sales across the board for their stores. Well, that'll do it for our news segment of the show. Coming up after this break, we'll talk with Quincy Valencia, the VP of Product Innovation for Hourly by AMS. Once again, going to be talking about hourly hiring, a subject that touches nearly every retailer. We talked at length last year about some of the challenges facing retail in terms of evaluating and onboarding associates, but even as we head into 2021, retailers are still fighting to hire large numbers of new employees into roles that, quite frankly, didn't exist 5 years ago, and also evaluate which potential new associates might be best suited for a role. To talk about the hiring process, we're pleased to be joined by Quincy Valencia, Vice President of Product Innovation for AMS, and specifically for Hourly by AMS, to discuss how retailers in grocery and general merchandise are doing exactly this: volume hiring and best practices surrounding hiring. Quincy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Trent. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, do you mind discussing a little bit about Hourly by AMS and what the Hourly platform does and even what AMS does on the day-to-day?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So AMS is really known as a global talent acquisition provider at large, both through different brand consultancies, tech consultancies, that sort of thing, just TA consultancy in general. Also, we're a global player in the RPO market for outsourcing. We do contingent workforce and so forth. In the past few years, we've noticed that, of course, the market is going in a different direction or a new opening direction with new technologies everywhere in an effort to really make sure that we continue to grow with the market and continue to have that ability and expertise to guide our clients and our prospects. We made the decision to really open up a digital workspace for ourselves and start developing product focused on hiring internally. And our very first product that we've launched is called Hourly, which is just as it sounds. It's a product that's focused on an end-to-end conversational hiring experience specifically for that hourly marketplace, which is a marketplace that I think many of your listeners will agree has been historically sort of neglected from this standpoint. So we've launched into hourly, solving problems for clients that we didn't even know existed, despite the fact that we have 4,500 people at AMS who've worked in talent acquisition for thousands of years combined, and that many of us in leadership grew up in the retail space. So it's been quite fascinating and exciting, and we're continuing to just delve into those issues and help our retail partners solve those issues.
Now, you mentioned a lot of hourly hiring, whether it be in retail or other job sectors out there, has been kind of neglected. It seems like it was stuck in the same era for about 30 or 40 years. When you started to develop the hourly platform and when your teams there at AMS started to look at this, what was kind of the current state of retail hourly hiring that you were looking at?
So hourly hiring in general, to your point, of which retail is a huge part, and again, to your point, has been traditionally recruited and process developed within a professional market. So if you go back to the dawn of even the ATS, you know, a million years ago now, it seems like those were developed because those companies couldn't find the talent that they need in the way that they could find hourly. It was all for their professional hires. There was no internet really much at that point, right? So how do we find somebody with this specific skill set, with this specific degree, or so on and so forth? It wasn't like that for the hourly worker. You could put a help wanted sign up, you could put an ad in the paper, and you could fill your jobs. And so for years, any sort of addition or development that was made in tech was made to support the original business issue, which was professional hiring. And then hourly was just kind of an add-on. And the other thing that was sort of, well, troublesome to me, having come from that era, is quite frankly, the hourly workforce is really sort of looked at as a commodity because it is a large volume, low complexity, low barrier to entry workforce. We've traditionally looked at it as, yeah, they'll leave, it's high turnover, but we'll find more. And if nothing else, 2020 showed us that that is not the case, that the hourly worker is the driver of our economy, and that when they go away, business stops. And so as we were looking to what we were going to do and how we were going to manage this technology, we wanted to make sure that we were making it easier for the candidate, that we were restoring that sort of dignity to the process and to the candidate instead of looking at it in that commoditized way. We're making it easier for a hiring manager who, let's face it, they are typically out on the floor making sure their in-caps are stocked and, you know, their registers are open and staffed. They're not sitting there in front of a computer screening resumes that you really don't necessarily need for this hourly worker. And then for, you know, recruiters, if they're involved, same thing. If you sponsor an ad on Indeed overnight and you get 500 applicants, how do you have any idea which of those applicants you should contact? If they all meet the minimum qualifications, how do you know who's going to be best? And if you don't get back to them, you're creating a poor candidate experience. So with all of those primary stakeholders at the forefront of our design, we set out to develop, again, this conversational hiring experience that would just make the process easier for everyone involved.
You mentioned for certain positions getting a glut of applications, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but you hit on something that I think is important to this because it is a two-way process. It's not just retailer going out to find an associate or a potential future associate. It's interfacing with them as well and making sure that that process is appropriate for the person that you're trying to attract to the position or the person that you're trying to hire. What are some changes that you've seen over the last 2 to 3 years in terms of developing that two-way communication?
Well, certainly the rise of the chatbot is attempting to be sort of a game changer. And I would say, when I say attempting to be, I'll actually go further and say it sort of has. A chatbot allows companies to put out that brand information to answer a lot of those questions that an applicant may have that previously they would never be able to answer until they went into an interview, or never able to get answered until they went for an interview. And at that point, if the answer to the question was not favorable, then the candidate says, oh, I can't do this job. Or the hiring manager says, yeah, you're not going to work. And now we've wasted everybody's time. So the rise of that bot on the front end for pre-screen, and at least for FAQ at the very least, has been sort of transformational in getting some information out there. And then speed has been another. I think everyone has recognized that if you force a candidate to apply on a computer instead of their mobile device, if you make them, you know, go through 45 minutes of an application, upload a resume that they either don't have or certainly don't have on their phone, so on and so forth, you're going to get a tremendous amount of candidate dropout. As you should, those things just aren't necessarily relevant for that candidate pool. And so you've seen technology after technology point solution come along into the marketplace to address some of those issues, and some have done that quite well. What we haven't seen, and where Hourly comes in, is a single platform that goes from the beginning to where you first engage with a candidate all the way through to the offer that is a seamless experience, so that you're not starting with a really cool slick chatbot on the front end and then dumping them into a long form legacy application process. And again, that's where your drop off comes. So Hourly kind of takes that entire process from the front where you're engaging, where again, some others have done over the past few years, through the pre-screen, through the FAQ, through the assessment. That's a really important piece. How do you even know if they're a right fit, and how do you get them to take it without dropping off? So Hourly's assessment is a visual assessment, takes about 90 seconds to get through. And then all the way through the schedule within about 6 minutes. Others have done similar in different components, which has been really important over the last couple of years. But we're doing sort of the whole shebang, and it's been received quite well by candidates and managers alike.
I want to ask you about the pre-screen and the FAQ and how it relates to chatbots. What are some effective practices that you're seeing retailers or others on this platform adopt in terms of not only, you know, obviously asking vetting questions of candidates, but also figuring out, hey, maybe a candidate won't work for this position, but maybe there's something else out there where it's valuable to keep their information?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. That's another one of our building blocks and missions at Hourly, is to try and cut waste out of the process as much as possible. And, you know, in retail, we all know that retailers work on small margins, generally speaking. And so if you're paying to acquire that same candidate over and over and over, you're wasting money and you're wasting time. And so built straight into the Hourly platform, you're going through a process. And does this work for you? Does this work for you? You're asking pre-screen questions. And if they're knocked out, because let's say they've applied for a role for which you have to be at least 18, instead of saying, sorry, you know, too bad, so sad, this isn't going to work for you, go look at some more jobs. What if we can redirect them to another job for which they may be qualified and may not have seen or may not have been interested in? Or what if they've applied for, you know, you could go to anywhere and you have a XYZ store in Miami, Florida, for example, and they have all of their recs posted there, and you don't know which one to apply for. Do I apply for the sales associate in the garden center? Do I apply for a cashier? Do I apply for a where? I'm not sure. There's 50. The candidate has no idea which one has the most applicants, which is going to close, and so forth. So we've introduced a concept that we sort of lovingly call the sorting hat, and hope that J.K. Rowling doesn't sue us at some point. But essentially, if you're going through and you're into a job, and then we actually ask a candidate what some of their own preferences or experiences are, and they choose sort of from a list. And from that, our technology in the back end will say, hey, we're happy to help you complete the application process for this particular role. But before we do that, here's a couple more that might be of more interest to you. And we present those to them based on their own personal preferences and experiences. And we give them the option to now leave their existing application process and go to another right there in line. Or they can stay and say, no, this is good, but I'm going to continue with what I have now. And so the whole goal is getting them and then keeping them in that process as long as you can. Let's keep them sticky, because we've already paid for them once and we've already brought them in once. And let's make their experience the best that we can, get them through a process for some job that will work for them, and save everybody some time and headache.
I think that's such an interesting idea, because who hasn't had that whole paradox of choice thing creep up when you go to a website and see there's 200 or 300 job openings and you're kind of wondering which one might be the best for you? I do want to address, as you mentioned, let's say you post a job on Indeed, suddenly you get 500 applications. It might be the case that only 20 of them even are qualified for this particular position. And especially since the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen this glut of an available workforce out there. How are companies now, and especially how are companies leveraging technology to sift through these applications to not only maybe reduce waste, as we're talking about here, but also making sure you find the right fit out of that 500?
You know, we've seen an influx of technology that helps with this. You have some video interviewing platforms that people have used where they're doing asynchronous interviews and reviewing those later. You've seen certainly their assessment vendors that are there. Of course, you've got the chatbot that's there. So it gets them through the pre-screen, which will knock out some. But then we want to, like you said, see to, okay, but of this large pool that still exists, say we've knocked out 20%, how do I know what to do? And so assessment is really valuable there to come in. And as long as you can have an assessment that will engage them enough to keep them to finish it, which is really important, you can really benchmark these candidates against people who've already been successful in role within your very company. And then those sort of rise to the cream of the crop. So those will be the first that you're calling, the first that you're inviting to interview, the first that are getting a shot at the job. And a lot of companies are adopting that sort of approach to kind of getting through that big pile of candidates and seeing who is best. What's equally important, though, and you didn't ask this, but it's critical, is that what then are you doing? If you have 20 roles and you have 500 applicants, you know, that's 480 people who you could have potentially interacted with, who may go away with a positive thing to say or a negative thing to say. And that will translate into dollars in your cash register one way or another. So we think it's critical that instead of just the thanks, don't call us, we'll call you email that a lot of people get, or even worse, when I was secret shopping one place, I got the email that said, we'll get back to you as soon as you can, but if we don't get back to you in 45 days, apply again, which I thought was horrifying. What's most important is that we're engaging again with the entire candidate pool in a way that's meaningful and personalized to them. So we actually go one step further here at Hourly and take their assessment result. And we have curated personalized content based on their own personality profile that we then continue to send to that candidate until they opt out of it, saying either we're sorry we didn't, you know, have a fit for you this time, but we thought this information might be interesting to you, or hey, we're glad you're scheduled for an interview. This might help you prep. And again, that information set is curated specifically for that candidate, whether they get a job or whether they don't, so that they leave that experience with a positive brand image of the retail clients that we have and the others as well.
You know, the funny thing is that was actually the next question I was going to ask, because we've talked about it. Chances are good if you're a retailer, most of the people that are applying to work at your particular store or wherever it might be are probably customers in the first place, and that's how they found out. So it's important to keep them around. And I'm curious, because you mentioned curating different messages based on application information, based on the inputs from that particular applicant if they don't get a position. What are some ways, or what are some examples that you might see out there of maybe tweaking that feedback back to the applicant in such a way that it meets with maybe their expectations that you've gleaned from the information that you've gotten from them?
I mean, quite honestly, the candidates are never, generally speaking, allowed to even present any of their expectations. So if you look at how we're dealing, and I say we as a global we in talent acquisition in general, have just done a really poor job at this historically. And I point the finger at myself as well. I'm included in that we. So if you don't even know what the candidate wants or what they want to ask or what they want to do, it becomes difficult to make that determination. So what we have done is taken their hierarchical archetype of their profile, and partnered with a team that's an expert in this very field to say, look at this archetype and look at some things that would be most important to them, either in preparing for an interview or where to look for a job or how to build a network or how to build rapport with a hiring manager or so on and so forth. And we've personalized that based on each different archetype or personality profile, depending on where they're in or where they currently or where they've been pushed out of the hiring process. So it's much more in depth than just a, hey, here's a library of information. We're looking at where they actually came through, how far they got in the process, what might pull them back in if they've abandoned, and pushing them that information specifically based on their own profile. And so in a large term, what somebody with that particular profile might be interested in. So if you're an extrovert, if you're hiring an extrovert standpoint, for example, and you're applying for a pick and pack job, you might really hate that job. So it might actually, because it doesn't really provide enough variety, for example, or interaction. And so if you didn't get that particular job, and by the way, I'm making all of this up as I go, but this is an example. If you didn't get that particular job, it might be that the content that we send really focuses on the type of job that they would be interested in. Like, hey, you'd be great potentially in a customer facing role where you have that face-to-face interaction and the ability to talk to people and so forth. You feed off of that generally. And then we might even send them a new list of jobs that they might want. So it really does depend on where they fall in that spectrum.
So we've talked about where retail hourly hiring was, and we've talked about where it could be or should be today. I want to pull out that crystal ball just a little bit. Looking 3-5 years in the future, what are some developments that you think we'll see in this space to further refine the way in which retailers hire for these hourly positions?
Well, first, and I'm going to cheat a little bit because we're already seeing several large retailers start to at least tiptoe into this route. But I see the retail hiring process becoming completely automated, where it becomes recruiterless, it becomes interviewless, because the technology will be at such a level that each party, so both the company and the candidate, will be able to properly gauge their interest in one another and whether they think they will fit and whether they think they will stay. Because that's the beauty of technology, is that it is evolving to such a point that we'll be able to do that. And the primary benefits of that are certainly on the client side, it's the time savings and it's the removal of some of the bias that we inherently insert into the process that we don't intend to. And it's speed, because you know as well as I do, and all of your listeners will know, sometimes it's just who gets to the candidate the fastest is who's going to get them. So speed through the process is critically important. And from the candidate side, it's sort of the same, right? You have so many choices. Where do I want to go? What do I want to do? And if I'm having a bad day and I'm out on my 15-minute break and I'm ready to look for something new, I better be able to get the answers to what I want and get in and get scheduled and get through in that break time, or else I'm not going to continue to apply there. So the biggest thing I see is going to recruiterless, interviewless hiring processes as we go forward. And then just in general, just the further use of technology to make these happen so that when you do have recruiters and managers in the process, they're available to take care of those things that you cannot automate, the things that you will not be able to do. It is still a human process. So it's important that you have those people there to manage all of those exceptions, to work with the one-offs, to, you know, if you have that really great department manager when you were out grocery shopping today that you engaged and you want to try and recruit them away to come to your department, you need to be able to focus on that person. They weren't an active applicant. And that's where the recruiters and the managers need to be spending their time, not with the 500 people who came in blind.
I can't count the number of times that I've tried to maybe recruit away from other retailers.
Absolutely.
Those department managers that you have a great experience with. Well, once again, Quincy Valencia, the VP of Product Innovation for AMS, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been great.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Quincy for joining us here on the show. And in our final segment, our Looking Ahead segment, we look ahead to alcohol delivery, something that in many markets wasn't even available pre-pandemic, has exploded since the beginning of the pandemic. And one could very easily say the main catalyst in this category is Drizly. And Drizly has reached a deal to be acquired now by Uber for $1.1 billion. It's a deal that features a combination of stock and cash. This comes, of course, after Uber acquiring Postmates, something a little bit more in their wheelhouse with, of course, Uber Eats. But I think this is interesting because, first of all, you've got a sector that, like I said, is relatively new. Regulations made it such that in many states, pre-pandemic, you couldn't get alcohol delivered, and some states still have those rules in place. But what I also think this may do, and this is why I'm looking ahead to this, is streamline everything for Uber, because Uber has said they plan on folding Drizly into their Uber Eats platform. It's going to make things a little bit more visible for customers because there are more Uber Eats customers than there are Drizly customers. So it's a great sign, certainly, as far as the Drizly platform is concerned, but it's also a potential great sign for independent liquor retailers, many of whom have partnered with Drizly over the last 9 months to 12 months with good success. And it all comes down to something we've mentioned a few times already on this podcast, cannibalization. Does a potential expansion of Drizly into more markets, into more areas, an expansion of visibility, does this cannibalize maybe from those in-store sales that those liquor stores were getting? Does it make sense from a margin standpoint for those liquor stores, or does it add to the sales of those independent liquor stores or chain liquor stores in certain circumstances? Is this a potential value add as people go to maybe order from Uber Eats, picking up something via Drizly or Drizly's platform as well? Now, again, we'll see whether or not they choose to keep the name, maybe use different marketing, use different techniques. But I am looking ahead at this because 2021, as we talked about recently on the show with Mike Provence, 2021 is going to be a big year for liquor retailers because there's a lot of dynamics to be watching out there. There's a lot of things. We're seeing sales increase, especially in terms of hard seltzer. That's taking sales away a little bit from wine. Where do sales pop up in 2021? Does a platform like Drizly being acquired by Uber and folded into Uber Eats, does that help sales? Does it hurt sales? Are sales simply indifferent? Does it hurt margins? So many things to look ahead to regarding this story. But I think from the liquor retailers that I've discussed, they're at least excited about this announced deal and the potential it might hold for them. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the podcast. Once again, we thank Quincy Valencia for joining us on the show. Next week, we'll have a discussion with Alexa Dryansky, head of market and consumer insights for retail at Alex Partners. Alexa will join us to talk about how fashion and apparel retail has been impacted by the pandemic and things to watch out for in 2021 as this segment of retail continues to necessarily evolve very quickly. One subject we talk a lot about is buying and how buying habits have changed and how this may have a trickle-down effect through the rest of the retail industry. It's a fascinating interview, and we hope to have you join us for it 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.